Welcome to our discussion segment on Persia Defeated. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. So this is a popular event.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah. This is a popular topic now, I believe.
Yes.
And it was made popular or more popular by a movie back in the 2000s.
Correct. But we'll get to that.
Absolutely. What was the beef between Sparta and Persia?
Well, first, it wasn't just Sparta that they were
right.
angry with. But
right.
So just to clarify that, Persia was expanding into a region of what is today Turkey, but at the time was controlled by the Greeks. It was the Ionian coast, which on a map is the west coast of Turkey. And the Persians wanted that land. It was basically a land grab, as was much of the ancient world. And the Greeks valued their freedom and their ideas of democracy, and the Persians weren't going to let them have that, and so there had to be a military conflict.
Can you provide some context on why Persia wanted to do the land grab? Because I think when we read history, it's just accepted this happened.
Because the Persian emperor saw it as their divine mandate to rule the world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was fairly brutal, but straightforward.
Yeah. So Sparta at the time was a different kind of society than the other Greek city-states.
Correct.
So that obviously had some influence in their ability to stand against Persia. But overall, the reason why they were able to do it was because of the geography that they chose,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Okay. Very, very often geography plays critical roles in battle that is often overlooked by scholars.
So honestly, how much of it was geography and how much of it was Spartan culture overall? Like what percentage would you give each part?
I can't give you a percentage. I don't know, because there are so many different factors going on at the same time. I mean, if you go to Thermopylae, and I haven't been there, but the photos and the descriptions that I've seen and read make it pretty clear that it's such a narrow, relatively speaking, a narrow area that any well-trained phalanx would have been able to hold that gap. Now, it was made easier by the fact that the Spartans were warriors, and that's all that they did. That was their entire ethos as a society. The men were warriors, and the women did everything else, along with the free Greeks and the slaves. So having 300 Spartans at the center of your phalanx certainly helped the overall morale of the other Greek troops, and there were many other Greek troops there. The movie 300 really focuses in on the Spartans, but history records that there were far more non-Spartans at the battle than there were Spartans. So how much of it was the Spartans? I think they helped, but overall, I think the pass could have been defended not relatively easily, but as well had the Spartans not been there.
All right.
Did that make sense? That was a really rough answer.
Yeah, it did. How would you compare the Battle of Thermopylae with the Battle of Marathon? In terms of, because I mean,
completely different in terms of geography.
Yeah, because it was still Greeks, but it wasn't Spartans. It wasn't as famous, I think, because of culture mainly, because culture and history have really kind of glamorized Spartans.
Yeah, and they shouldn't, because the Spartans were horrible, horrible people. That's a modern interpretation. Yeah. I personally am revolted by their eugenics and other things. But anyway, Marathon was much more of an open field battle. So you had basically a phalanx against the mad rush of Persians, and the phalanx held. So it was a traditional battle, whereas Thermopylae was very much meant to be a last stand. It was meant to be basically where you canalize the enemy into a very small area.
So
which was more important? Thermopylae.
Right.
But Marathon, if you want to talk about like lessons from history, lessons from military history, Marathon teaches you far more about,
okay.
I mean, we get the word military from the leader of the Greeks at the Battle of Marathon.
Yeah.
Militarides.
Did the Persians' loss at Thermopylae, and I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but I'm genuinely curious, was it their overconfidence and underestimation of the Spartans? Because I've read several accounts where Persian spies before the battle started, or the days before battle, saw the Spartans preparing for battle.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they prepared was they would have oil in their beards, they would have their hair brushed and all those things. So it looked to the Persians like these guys were not really
not
warriors.
Serious.
Yeah. And so there was there could have been this overconfidence. Do you agree with that?
I don't know how much of that is historically accurate. Most of those stories came from Greek historians or Roman historians who are seeking to glorify certain ancient cultures and to denigrate others. So I don't know how much of that is historically accurate. Assuming that it was, there was certainly some overconfidence on the part of the Persians, because to that point, the Persians and specifically the Immortals, which was the center of their army, these 10,000 warriors who they didn't look like Kabuki ninjas like in the movie, but they were the best army in the world. And they had suffered the occasional military defeat, but nothing as calamitous as what they suffered in Greece. So an army that wins battle after battle after battle is, of course, going to be very confident. Yeah. Now, was it overconfidence? Possibly. Xerxes was certainly surprised. I mean, history records that he stood up from his throne three times just in shock that his troops weren't able to overrun these Greek hoplites.
On that note, explain to our audience how the Greek soldiers would form in battle. Mm-hmm. What was the phalanx?
Think of it like a coiled spring. So you would have ranks of men forming in a line horizontally, so shoulder to shoulder. You would carry, in your left hand, you would carry a shield, and that shield was large enough that it covered your body and the body of the man to your left, basically from thigh to neck. So it covered the most important parts of your body other than the head. In your right hand, you had a spear, and the spear was basically set on the shield, pointing outward. Obviously, you don't want to point the spear in the other direction. And it formed a wall of either wood or bronze and spear points. Now, when the enemy charged and they hit that first line, the first line would take a step back until their backs hit the shield of the men in the second rank. And then the second rank would step back until their backs hit the third rank. And then at that point, the third rank, which contained the most senior officers, they would shout as one, push. So the spring has been pushed back, and then at that order, push, they would all rush forward and basically just hurl the enemy away from them.
And they were able to continue doing that repeatedly?
Yeah, as long as the phalanx held, as long as there were no breaks in the line. If a man was injured, he was taken to the back, and the person in the second rank would move up to the first rank, third rank to the second rank, and then they'd have troops in reserve behind them to fill in that gap in the third rank.
Which is why geography matters. So you can't flank around that block of men, right?
Well, you can.
No, I'm saying, like, if they're
not
in a place,
at Thermopylae, you couldn't. Right, yes, because you had the water on one side and you had the hills on the other. Yes. That's why geography mattered so much at Thermopylae.
Yeah. So what was the major difference? Just talking about Salamis, less popular, just because there was a film about it, but we won't talk about that. in terms of the Athenian navy and the Greeks on the water, did Persia have any idea that they were so skilled on the water? And if so, would they have changed their tactics?
No, and that was the battle where it was either ignorance or overconfidence really came into play. Yeah. Because the Greeks have been mariners since the dawn of Greek civilization. 500-600 years of Greeks being on the water, they know how to handle their ships and they know how to fight on the water. Persians had a navy, obviously, but they were not a seagoing people. Persia is largely desert or mountains. So they had allies from the coastal regions who knew how to sail, and they sailed relatively well, but not as well as the Greeks did. So, again, either overconfidence or ignorance. I mean, the Greek general Themistocles is able to outwit the Persians and kind of trick them into attacking, and the way he positioned his fleet was fairly brilliant. So I don't want to diminish what Themistocles did, but it was also Persian mistakes that led to that victory.
What was the mindset of the Greeks when they battled Persia? Was it truly about freedom, or is that something that's been...
Depends on the city-state. Athens, yes, it was about freedom. Some of the other lesser city-states, it was about freedom, and it was about the spoils of war. Sparta, I think it was just because they loved war. That's basically what they did.
Yeah, Sparta culture.
Yeah, Sparta was not a democratic society like Athens was, so... If you're a Spartan, you don't really care about political freedom because your entire focus on the whole point of your existence is to die for your state, is to die for your country. So if I can do that, then I have lived a good life. And this was an opportunity to do that. Now, I'm sure they didn't want to die, but if they were, you know, there's a war on, that's what we have to do. It's our duty.
So if the traitor hadn't turned against the Spartans, do you believe, and this is speculative history more so, that they would have been able to hold the hot gates?
I don't know, because they were still extremely outnumbered. I think eventually the ratio of Greeks to Persians, they probably would have been overwhelmed. But the Persian army probably would not have been able to continue the conquest. I think there probably would have been so much damage done to the Persians at Thermopylae had they been able to fight for more than 3 days, had the Greeks been able to fight for more than 3 days, that they might not have completed the conquest.
Okay.
But again, that's speculation.
Was the battle at the Hot Gates a pivotal point because it bought the Athenian Navy time to organize, or that they just held the Persians back long enough for everyone else to get in place?
It was both. It was to give the Athenian Navy time. It was to give all the Peleus the chance to mobilize their armies, for the Carneia to pass the religious holiday where you're not supposed to fight. It basically bought Greece time to arm up and to be prepared for the war that was coming. That's why it's a turning point.
What would have been the consequence of the loss of Greek culture? Let's say...
Oh, boy.
Let's say that Persia did win, mm-hmm. and that they conquered all of Greece. What would have been the result? You talked about it in the podcast, but again, it's such a big question and a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. You don't have the influence, certainly, of democracy and the idea of people being able to exercise their voice and vote. That did not exist anywhere else in the ancient world that I know of. So that idea would have been stamped out pretty effectively. Every other culture, again, certainly in Western history, which is really my area of expertise and what we're talking about today, every other culture was entirely religious-based. And there's nothing wrong with a civilization based solely on religion, but there are some downsides. If you believe that everything that happens is a result of God or the gods directly intervening in your life, and you don't have any free will, which is almost every ancient religion outside of Judaism and later Christianity and Islam, the concept of free will is unknown. And free will is what allows people, or what encourages people, to better themselves, to work, to strive, to live a better life, and to pass on a better life to their children than they themselves had. So that would have been, if not destroyed, it would have been certainly lessened, because the whole idea of the good life for the Greeks was to live well in this world. It wasn't to please the gods. It was, I'm going to enjoy my life. I'm going to respect the gods and honor the gods, but they don't direct my life. I direct my life. So it would have been tough to have that, and that's a key element to the subsequent development of Western civilization. Finally, the whole idea of Greek philosophy, which is far too broad to get into in a 15-minute podcast or a 45-minute discussion, but the basis of Greek philosophy is reason, that the human mind is able to look at a problem in an unbiased way and solve it based on what is going to be genuinely the best solution to this problem. Not what do the gods want, or what does my king want, or what does my paterfamilias want, but what is going to benefit me, not to harm anyone else, but just it's self-interest. That's gone, because that also did not, Rome didn't have that. Rome acquired that from Greece.
Right.
Now, again, delving deeper into speculation, and I apologize to my fellow historians.
It's my fault. Sorry.
Let's say the Romans still conquer the known world, which is probably what would have happened. Yeah, the Romans.
Okay.
Yeah, because Greeks are gone.
Right.
Greeks are gone, but the Romans up against the Persians, or whoever eventually took out the Persians, the Romans, as we're going to talk about in a couple of weeks, had the best military of the ancient world, hands down, destroyed the phalanxes. Roman culture minus reason is sheer barbarism beyond anything we can even contemplate. It was Greek reason that was integrated into Roman culture in a way that is really quite remarkable. The Greeks were allowed to continue to teach and to think and to write, and their ideas of reason moderated the vicious, warlike culture of Rome that we'll see when we talk about the Punic Wars in a couple weeks, basically created a restraining influence on that.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the Romans were also much more pluralistic in terms of religion. They allowed people to practice whatever beliefs they wanted as long as they paid their taxes and were loyal to the empire. Again, let's delve even more into what ifs. The Romans conquer, but there's no Greek reason or anything like that. When a 30-year-old Jew starts walking around in the Holy Land saying, I'm the son of God, what are the Romans, who are not pluralistic, who don't respect people's freedom of thought, what do they do to that man?
Not good things.
Not good things. He doesn't get his 3-year ministry before he's crucified. He is crucified on day one.
Yeah.
So there goes Christianity.
Interesting.
So there's a lot to this whole idea of Greek culture
in our
world today.
I mean, it's still, I don't want to say popular, but it's still it's still part of our education.
It's the basis of our education.
Right.
The only reason why we have the modern education system that exists everywhere in the world is because of the Socratic method.
Yeah.
Embracing ignorance as the beginning of learning, mm-hmm. and asking the question, why? Why do these things happen? Mm-hmm. Not just they do because the gods told us, or because the king told us, or because our paterfamilias told us, but what's the real reason? What's the root cause?
Right. Great point.
All that's gone.
Back to Persia.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked earlier about what Persia was used to. Yeah, they encountered the shock of the hot gates.
And Marathon 10 years earlier.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So they had encountered the losses, but their drive to conquer was very, very powerful. And Salamis happened, and then all of a sudden they're not as interested as they once were. Right. And there were other
Well, I was going to say, something we didn't get into in the podcast, Xerxes was also facing troubles back home.
And that leads into the question. Yeah. Like what was it that changed his mind? Why was Greece not as appealing as it was before? It wasn't just the battles.
No.
Because I feel like he was arrogant enough to just like, I don't care, I'm gonna keep trying.
Well, I don't want to ascribe motives to the guy. I don't think he ever considered himself to be a god, and he was certainly not a fabulous,
no, I'm not
bald, seven-foot-tall man.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that from everything I've read about him, it was not easily deterred.
Oh, that's certainly true. Yeah. It was the combination of the loss to his military, which lessens your striking power against other enemies, combined with the fact that there were rebellions, I believe it was in Egypt and in Babylon, that are much closer to the Persian home base, if you will, back in what is today Iran, that had to be dealt with. And so he left a small force in Greece to try and complete the conquest and basically to save face, and the rest of his army returned to Persia.
Yeah.
He was also concerned about that the bridges that he had built across the Dardanelles Straits. He thought the Greeks might try and take those. And if that happens, well, his navy's at the bottom of the Bay of Salamis. His army is now trapped in Europe if they take those bridges, and the empire is doomed. Everyone will rise up, and Persia's there is no more Persia. So he had to. He was arrogant, but he was also practical, and he realized that as much as I want to conquer Greece, it's a tiny corner of the world, and I've got much bigger problems I have to go deal with.
So one of the reasons why the Battle of Thermopylae has been popularized in culture is the 300, or not the 300, 300.
Yeah.
That was back in the 2000s, and there was a follow-up movie to it, which was terrible, about Salamis.
We won't even mention the name of that
movie.
No, it doesn't
deserve it. It's like lost into the past. Yeah.
You retain only information that's important.
That actually matters.
Yeah.
So I'm going to venture a guess that there were no actual goat people that the Persians had, nor giant monsters with swords for hands.
No.
Nor were the, and you spoke about this earlier, were the immortals monsters
no.
either. So there were no chained monsters. There were no goat people. There also, and I know I wasn't going to say this, but in the Salamis movie, there's a scene where the character...
Themistocles.
Yeah, thank you. Is on a horse, and he's riding across a burning ship, jumps from that ship to another burning ship.
I don't remember that part.
I remember that because I'm like... You lost me. Like, it was just kind of
there's
like,
only one scene in that movie that I remember, and because it was so disturbing, I think everyone in the entire theater is just like, okay, this should not.
I don't want to remember what that was, but just FYI, a horse would not jump from ship to ship, especially in fire.
Frank Miller wrote it that way.
Yeah,
so
I don't think he did. Did he? Is that based on a graphic novel? Because I know 300 is. Okay.
In that case, it's Zack Snyder, which is even worse.
Yeah. So that's why it's so popular.
Yes.
How much of that movie was actually true, or either of the films? There are obvious ones that
I'm not going to talk about the second one because I don't remember.
Okay, so just talk about the first one.
I do know there was... The woman in the second movie is based on a historical character.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of like her name, I don't think there's anything else that's accurate about how she was portrayed beyond her name and the fact that she was a Greek serving the Persians. In terms of the first movie, I mean, the story is largely accurate. I'm trying to think if there were... Well, like, Ephialtes was not a deformed golem-looking character, and he wasn't... I know he wasn't. He was not a Spartan who had been exiled or anything like that. So the broad outlines of the story are correct, and there are moments in the film, like their depiction of the phalanx, is very accurate until... Leonidas strolls his way through the Persian lines, just killing one person after another. Great scene, beautifully shot. Not how the phalanx worked. The phalanx, if the king had gone for a stroll like that, the phalanx would have collapsed and everyone would have died.
stroll?
Well,
Excuse me, everybody.
It's all in slow motion.
Yeah.
So he's strolling slowly and killing like 30 guys as he goes.
Yeah.
But again, it's based on a graphic novel. It's not meant to be historical literature or anything like that. I will say that one of my professors in college, Victor Davis Hanson, who's probably the premier, certainly the premier classics historian and probably one of the best military historians generally, he loved that movie. He wrote a review of it a couple years after I was out of college when 300 came out. And he said it's the best depiction of the ideals of Greece that he has ever seen on film. Now, it's applied to the wrong country, or the wrong city-state, because Sparta didn't care about freedom, and that whole, like, the speech at the end, right, given by the guy who lost his eye, Faramir.
Not his name in the movie.
No.
It's Lord of the Rings.
The actor David Wenham. I forget the guy's name. Anyway, that really did capture the ideals of freedom that that Athens and a lot of the other city-states were fighting for.
Okay.
So I would say that the themes in 300 and the broad outline of the story was accurate. The geography of Thermopylae was nothing like what is portrayed on film. It's not on the edge of a cliff. There aren't cliffs above Thermopylae either. There was a storm, but it wasn't off the coast of Thermopylae. It was further north. The Spartans didn't watch the Persians all drown or anything like that. And as you said, there weren't goat people in Xerxes' tent, nor was he a 7-foot-tall giant monster or anything like that.
So down to specific details, did the Spartans have metal shields?
Some of them had bronze. Coated shields.
Okay.
They weren't solid bronze. It would have been wood covered in.
Did the Spartans wear armor? Or was it like...
They wore helmets.
Okay. So shield, and helmet, they wore capes, spear.
But that was all the Spartans.
So they'd had no sword, or they battle. Did have a sword?
No, they had a sword, but it was in their
shield.
It was carried on their shield, but...
So in contrast, when you think about reading these two events, the Battle of Thermopylae and Salamis, who are some credible sources that you can go to actually read about the events? Because Herodotus is not always considered a valid source. I mean, he's valid because he's ancient, but I mean, what?
Yeah, he's the first to write about it.
Yeah, in terms of slight embellishments, though.
Yeah, a few. Polybius is a little bit better, and there are a couple others whose names I don't remember. I'll put them into the transcript that I send,
great,
or that we post on the website. But the best sources are probably, and again, I don't remember their names. There are a couple Romans who tried to compile a history of Greece and kind of filter through the myths from the facts. And we'll put those up on the website as well, because I don't remember their names off the top of my head. But it's tough. I mean, we can't even get some of our own history in this country right, in terms of getting out the facts and historical truth. So how are we going to do it in a culture that's 2,400 years old?
Yeah.
So maybe there were monsters with swords for hands.
Could be.
No, that's not true.
Did the Persians have elephants, or was that an embellishment?
I don't know if they had elephants, actually. I mean, the Persians ruled areas of the world where elephants live.
No armor-clad rhinos, though, right?
No.
Just FYI. I think in history, the Spartans are quoted as when they're told to lay down their arms.
I think I saw that on a t-shirt at a gun show once.
Yeah. It's just a very popular thing, them telling the Persians to come and get them. Mm-hmm. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, accurate has an asterisk with everything here. It's as accurate as we know it can be. Yes.
Do we remember Thermopylae and Salamis for the reasons that we've been talking about, or is it because of the glamorized accounts from Herodotus and other authors, where we have this fantastic story in history where you think, like, Age of Heroes, mm-hmm, oh my gosh, this is impossible odds, and they stood their ground and they won. While that's inspiring, do we remember it only for those reasons, in your opinion? When you've taught classes, when you've talked to others in your field about this, mm-hmm, this topic, or is it because it saved Greek culture, or is it both?
Well, that's a good question. I kind of have to disagree with you in terms of, you characterize this as being something that's relatively well known. I mean, 300, when it came out, it did, for a time, it revitalized interest in Greece generally, and specifically at Thermopylae. But I mean, I've talked to students who are movie buffs who've not seen 300. No. And so when I bring up Thermopylae...
I think it depends on the circle you're in.
Well, so, yeah. But I mean, so young people today, they don't know a whole lot about Thermopylae. And when I teach them about it, they're like, wow, that's such a cool story. And then we bring in the whole, well, yeah, but there would be no Greek culture and all of that. So when I talk to other people in my field, it's respect for what those men did at Thermopylae, and also a recognition of what could have happened. But generally among the population, I would imagine that if they know about the story of what happened at Thermopylae and Salamis, which is probably even less well-known, it's probably for the cool stories and less for the actual long-term importance, which is one of the reasons why we're talking about it.
Absolutely. Do you think the Spartans and Greeks overall knew that these battles were changing the course of history?
No. No, I don't.
I don't think so either.
No. I quickly running through the list of topics we have for this season, I don't know that any of the people that we're going to be talking about who are involved in the events of these various turning points were like waking up in the morning saying, today I'm going to change history.
Yeah.
With the possible exception of Churchill.
Yeah, I don't think he said that every day.
No, not every day. But I think in the and maybe there are others who in the darkest of days are like, okay, if everything goes my way, this will be a turning point in history. But they couldn't know that it was going to go their way.
Do you think that one of the things that contributes to those turning points, like thinking about these events, is you have individuals who have a conviction and they take a stand that's not popular and not something that is that people believe will be successful, but in their minds it doesn't matter because they have this conviction, they have this job to do, and so it's not about convenience, it's not about how they feel about it specifically in terms of I'm probably going to lose, you know, so maybe I shouldn't do this. Like it wasn't that. It's like no. Like if you're Spartan, that's your life, that's your culture. You want to die for the state.
Yeah.
If you're Athenian or any other Greek, it's just like it's freedom. Like I want that, or in some version of freedom.
Yeah.
Maybe obviously everybody has their own intentions, but thinking overall themes here is trying to look for that common theme, that thread in history of those turning points. Is it conviction in your opinion?
Sometimes it's one of the dangers when you're looking at history is don't ascribe motives that are not crystal clear. So I don't want to say that yes, every one of the Athenians who picked up his spear and sword and was like, all right, I'm going to go defend the freedom of my country because I just don't know. For Leonidas, it was military strategy. It was, we have got to buy time for the Carneia to end, for our army to be able to mobilize to defeat the Persians and to protect our city. So I can't speak to general motivations of the Athenians. Now, more broadly stuff we're going to be talking about this season, there are some instances where yes, they're like, we fully expect to lose, or we fully expect to fail at our efforts to cure this disease. We fully expect not to be able to solve this horrible problem that's facing our culture, but we're going to try. And it's that conviction and that persistence. But there are some times where these turning points happen entirely by accident.
Right.
So, I mean, Gutenberg from last week is a perfect example. He didn't set out to create a world in which you could read anything and you could learn anything through the printed word. He just wanted to make a quick buck.
Mm-hmm.
So that was not conviction, beyond the conviction of, I'm going to go to debtor's prison. Right. If I don't get this
which
done.
Which is a strong conviction.
Well, it is. Yeah. But I don't think the kind it's you were talking about.
Not a generally moral, upstanding one. Right,
no,
right.
Not so much.
It's
So the short answer is sometimes.
Yeah. I'm reminded of a movie, Dunkirk.
Yeah,
it's a great film. There's a scene in that film where one of the pilots is rescued. No, he was a soldier. He was saved by one of the English boats.
Mm-hmm.
And the man in the boat told the soldier that, you know, we're going back to get more of you.
Mm-hmm.
And the soldier said, no, you can't go back there. Like, don't do it. And the reason why I love that scene, and yes, it is a film, but it is, I would say that film is pretty accurate.
Well, that did happen. There were soldiers in the Dunkirk evacuation who were like,
yeah,
we can't go back.
But his response is poignant. He just said, we have a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter that we may die.
Yeah.
Like, we have to go and help these people. We have to go and help get these soldiers off. This is our task. So I'm not trying to glamorize anything, but it is interesting when you look at history and you ask, why would a Spartan, I get it. I get that that's Spartan culture, but in the back of your mind, there's that reason that says, I am facing hundreds of thousands of Persian soldiers coming at us right now. And I know they wouldn't have quit. They wouldn't have fled or any of that, or even Athens, like at Salamis, when they're on the ocean, that thought has to cross their mind. Mm-hmm. They're not part of that same culture, obviously, but it's just kind of like, what compelled them to act the way they did? And that's always a subject that I'm always interested in.
Yeah.
It's like, what was your reason? Why did you take the stand?
Yeah.
And so I didn't expect an answer.
Yeah, I mean, that's more of a psychological question. I mean, the motivations for a Spartan were certainly different than for an Athenian. I don't know that a Spartan would have been like, I've got 100,000 Persians coming at me. I think I may die. I don't know that that would have crossed their minds, because that whole idea of self-preservation had been so thoroughly trained out of them.
Yeah.
Just, again, based on what we know of Spartan culture. So, again, not to disagree with you, but to say that there are so many perspectives that you have to kind of try and integrate into.
Yeah, and I'm not saying
finding
there's a
an answer
reason.
To something like that. But it's important for students of history to look at the facts and certainly to draw conclusions, but not to try and overdraw conclusions and say, all right, I can learn this lesson for me that, you know, I am inspired by the Spartans. I know guys who have joined the military who have Molon Lave and other Spartan tattoos and things like that. They almost idolize that culture, and that's fine to an extent. Again, they were pretty brutal people, but that is not a historical way of looking at the Spartans. That is, I am inspired by what they did, and that's fine, but it's not history. History looks at what they did and says, okay, these are the facts. Now, what can we draw? What long-term impacts can we see coming from that?
Yeah.
It's not about, well, why did they do it? That's more psychology.
Right. And I think what I'm getting at is, as we go through this season, trying to break down, probably unsuccessfully, the turning point question.
Yeah.
Like, what constitutes the historical turning point? I know we talked about that last week.
Yeah.
But and you gave a great answer in terms of, you know, these are the turning points to you.
Mm-hmm.
But historically, people look at them as turning points. Like the people I talk to, they talk about events like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly commonplace. And again, it depends on your circle. But
yeah.
Like, so as we go through this season, you're going to hear me ask a lot. And I'm sure when I talk to, you'll probably ask the same thing. Like, trying to look for that. If there is a common thread, exploring it. And if there's not, there's not.
Yeah.
But if there's a common theme somewhere where we can see the catalyst for the turning point, besides the event, because it's the person involved in the event, and mm-hmm. what was their motivation for taking that stand or doing this thing or not doing this thing that would make what happened such a big deal. And so that's probably a theme we're going to come back to.
Yeah, we will. And as long as it's grounded in the pursuit of historical truth and not, I have to find a common theme. That's where I think a lot of people, and I have to kind of critique some people in my own profession and who share my worldview on this stuff, they look at history and they say, okay, how can we apply this, what they did, and the themes of what was going on in that country, say, to America today? We saw so much of this right after 9/11, where people were just like, all right, we're going to be the Spartans here. We're going to stand united. And the situation was so wildly different. What happened on 9/11, the tragedy that it was, not in any way diminishing that, but it is not the same as what the Spartans did. Al-Qaeda did not have 100,000 soldiers on our border ready to cross the Rio Grande. We had to stop them. So to say America is going to be Sparta, or we're going to be Athens, or we're going to be this and that, that is not a historical way of looking at it. So I want us to avoid that this season as we're doing that.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Persia Defeated. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you hear this podcast. It really does help. Thanks, and see you all next week.